Side 15. It, by Stephen King. Continuing on page 542. Carol Danner smiled, and the smile changed her pretty face into one that was beautiful.
"I think that's very sweet," she said. "If you'd like to browse for 10 or 15 minutes, I'll have the card made up for you when you come back to the desk."
Ben grinned a little. "I guess there'll be a fee," he said, "out of toner and all."
"Did you have a card when you were a boy?"
"I sure did," Ben smiled. "Except for my friends, I guess that library card was the most important."
"Ben, would you come up here?"
A voice called suddenly, cutting across the library hush like a scalpel. He turned around, jumping guiltily the way people do when someone shouts in the library. He saw no one he knew, and realized a moment later that no one had looked up or shown any sign of surprise or annoyance. The old men still read their copies of the Derry News, the Boston Globe, National Geographic, Time, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report. At the tables in the reference room, two high school girls still had their heads together over a stack of papers and a pile of file cards. Several browsers went on looking through the books on the shelves marked Current Fiction, 7-Day Loan. An old man in a ridiculous driving cap, a cold pipe clenched between his teeth, went on leafing through a folio of Luis de Vargas sketches. He turned back to the young woman who was looking at him, puzzled.
"Is anything wrong?"
"No," Ben said, smiling. "I thought I heard something. I guess I'm more jet-lagged than I thought.
What were you saying?"
"Well, actually, you were saying. But I was about to add that if you had a card when you were a resident, your name will still be in the files," she said. "We keep everything on microfiche now. Some change from when you were a kid here, I guess."
"Yes," he said.
"A lot of things have changed in Derry. But a lot of things also seem to have remained the same. Anyway, I can just look you up and give you a renewal card, no charge."
"That's great," Ben said.
And before he could add thanks, the voice cut through the library's sacramental silence again, louder now, ominously jolly.
"Come on up, Ben. Come on up, you fat little fuck. This is your life, Ben Hanscom."
Ben cleared his throat. "I appreciate it," he said.
"Don't mention it," she cocked her head at him. "Has it gotten warm outside?"
"A little," he said.
"Why?"
"You're..."
"Ben Hanscom did it,"
the voice screamed. It was coming from above, coming from the stacks.
"Ben Hanscom killed the children. Get him, grab him."
"Perspiring," she finished.
"Am I?" he said idiotically.
"I'll have this made up right away," she said.
"Thank you."
She headed for the old Royal typewriter at the corner of her desk. Ben walked slowly away, his heart a thudding drum in his chest. Yes, he was sweating. He could feel it trickling down from his forehead, his armpits matting the hair on his chest. He looked up and saw Pennywise the Clown standing at the top of the left-hand staircase, looking down at him. His face was white with grease paint. His mouth bled lipstick in a killer's grin. There were empty sockets where his eyes should have been. He held a bunch of balloons in one hand and a book in the other.
"Not he," Ben thought. "It."
"I am standing here in the middle of the Derry Public Library's rotunda on a late spring afternoon in 1985. I am a grown man, and I am face to face with my childhood's greatest nightmare. I am face to face with it."
"Come on up, Ben," Pennywise called down. "I won't hurt you. I've got a book for you. A book and a balloon. Come on up."
Ben opened his mouth to call back, "You're insane if you think I'm going up there," and suddenly realized that if he did that, everyone here would be looking at him, everyone here would be thinking, "Who is that crazy man?"
"Oh, I know you can't answer," Pennywise called down and giggled. "Almost fooled you there for a minute, though, didn't I? Pardon me, sir, do you have Prince Albert in a can?" "You do? Better let the poor guy out." "Pardon me, ma'am, is your refrigerator running?" "It is. Then hadn't you better go catch it?"
The clown on the landing threw its head back and shrieked laughter. It roared and echoed in the dome of the rotunda like a flight of black bats, and Ben was only able to keep from clapping his hands over his ears with a tremendous effort of will.
"Come on up, Ben," Pennywise called down. "We'll talk. Neutral ground. What do you say?"
"I'm not coming up there," Ben thought. "When I finally come to you, you won't want to see me, I think. We're going to kill you."
The clown shrieked laughter again.
"Kill me? Kill me?"
And suddenly, horribly, the voice was Richie Tozier's voice. Not his voice, precisely, but Richie Tozier doing his pickaninny voice.
"Don't kill me, massa. I be a good nigger. Don't kill this yer black boy, haystack.
then that shrieking laughter again.
Trembling, white-faced, Ben walked across the echoing center of the adults' library. He felt that soon he would vomit. He stood in front of a shelf of books and took one down at random with a hand that trembled badly. His cold fingers flittered the pages.
"This is your one chance, Haystack,"
the voice called from behind and above him.
"Get out of town. Get out before it gets dark tonight. I'll be after you tonight, you and the others. You're too old to stop me, Ben. You're all too old. Too old to do anything but get yourselves killed. Get out, Ben. Do you want to see this tonight?"
He turned slowly, still holding the book in his icy hands. He didn't want to look, but it was as if there were an invisible hand under his chin, tilting his head up and up and up. The clown was gone. Dracula was standing at the top of the left-hand stairway. But it was no movie Dracula. It was not Bela Lugosi or Christopher Lee or Frank Langella or Francis Lederer or Reggie Nalder. An ancient man-thing with a face like a twisted root stood there. Its face was deadly pale, its eyes purplish-red, the color of blood clots. Its mouth dropped open, revealing a mouthful of Gillette blue blades that had been set in the gums at angles. It was like looking into a deadly mirror maze where a single misstep could get you cut in half.
"Key wrench!"
it screamed, and its jaws snapped closed. Blood gouted from its mouth in a red-black flood. Chunks of its severed lips fell to the glowing white silk of its formal shirt and slid down its front, leaving snail trails of blood behind.
"What did Stan Ura see before he died?"
The vampire on the landing screamed down at him, laughing through the bloody hole of its mouth.
"Was it Prince Albert in a can? Was it Davy Crockett, King of the Wild Frontier? What did he see, Ben? Do you want to see it, too? What did he see? What did he see?"
Then that shrieking laughter again. And Ben knew that he would scream now himself. Yes, there was no way to stop the scream. It was going to come. Blood was pattering down from the landing in a grisly shower. One drop had landed on the arthritis-bunched hand of an old man who was reading the Wall Street Journal. It was running down between his knuckles, unseen and unfelt. Ben hitched in breath, sure the scream would follow, unthinkable in the quiet of this softly drizzling spring afternoon, as shocking as the slash of a knife or a mouthful of razor blades. Instead, what came out in a shaky, uneven rush, spoken instead of screamed, spoken low like a prayer, were these words.
"We made slugs out of it, of course. We made the silver dollar into silver slugs."
The gentleman in the driving cap, who had been perusing the De Vargas sketches, looked up sharply.
"Nonsense,"
he said. Now people did look up. Someone hissed, "Shh," at the old man in an annoyed voice.
"I'm sorry,"
Ben said in a low, trembling voice. He was faintly aware that his face was now running with sweat and that his shirt was plastered to his body.
"I was thinking aloud."
"Nonsense,"
the old gentleman repeated in a louder voice.
"Can't make silver bullets from silver dollars. Common misconception. Pulp fiction. Problem is with specific gravity."
Suddenly the woman, Miss Danner, was there.
"Mr. Brockhill, you'll have to be quiet," she said kindly enough. "People are reading."
"Man's sick," Brockhill said abruptly and went back to his book. "Give him an aspirin, Carol."
Carol Danner looked at Ben and her face sharpened with concern.
"Are you ill, Mr. Hanscom? I know it's terribly impolite to say so, but you look terrible."
Ben said, I had Chinese food for lunch. I don't think it's agreed with me."
"If you want to lie down, there's a cot in Mr. Hanlon's office. You could..."
"No, thanks, but no."
What he wanted was not to lie down, but to get the hell out of the Derry Public Library. He looked up at the landing. The clown was gone. The vampire was gone. But tied to the low wrought iron railing which surrounded the landing was a balloon. Written on its bulging skin were the words, "Have a good day. Tonight you die."
"I've got your library card," she said, putting a tentative hand on his arm. "Do you still want it?"
"Yes, thanks," Ben said.
He drew a deep, shuddery breath.
"I'm very sorry about this."
"I just hope it isn't food poisoning," she said.
"Wouldn't work,"
Mr. Brockhill said, without looking up from De Vargas or removing his dead pipe from the corner of his mouth.
"Device of pulp fiction. Bullet would tumble."
And speaking again with no foreknowledge that he was going to speak, Ben said,
"Slugs, not bullets.
We realized almost right away that we couldn't make bullets. I mean, we were just kids. It was my idea to..."
"Shh,"
someone said again.
Rocchio gave Ben a slightly startled look, seemed about to speak, then went back to the sketches. At the desk, Carol Danner handed him a small orange card with Derry Public Library stamped across the top. Bemused, Ben realized it was the first adult library card he had owned in his whole life. The one he'd had as a kid had been canary yellow.
"Are you sure you don't want to lie down, Mr. Hanscom?"
"I'm feeling a little better, thanks."
"Sure?"
He managed a smile. "I'm sure."
"You do look a little better," she said, but she said it doubtfully, as if understanding that this was the proper thing to say, but not really believing it.
Then she was holding a book under the microfilm gadget they use these days to record book loans, and Ben felt a touch of almost hysterical amusement.
"It's the book I grabbed off the shelf when the clown started to do its pickaninny voice," he thought. "She thought I wanted to borrow it. I've made my first withdrawal from the Derry Public Library in 25 years, and I don't even know what the book is. Furthermore, I don't care. Just let me out of here, okay? That'll be enough." "Thank you," he said, putting the book under his arm.
"You're more than welcome, Mr. Hanscom. Are you sure you wouldn't like an aspirin?"
"Quite sure," he said, and then hesitated.
"You wouldn't by any chance know what happened to Mrs. Sterrett, would you? Barbara Sterrett? She used to be the head of the children's library."
"She died," Carol Danner said, 3 years ago. "It was a stroke, I understand. It was a great shame. She was relatively young, 58 or 9, I think. Mr. Hanlon closed the library for the day."
"Oh," Ben said, and felt a hollow place open in his heart.
"That's what happened when you got back to your used to be, as the song put it. The frosting on the cake was sweet, but the stuff underneath was bitter. People forgot you, or died on you, or lost their hair and teeth. In some cases you found that they had lost their minds. Oh, it was great to be alive. Boy, howdy."
"I'm sorry," she said. "You liked her, didn't you?"
"All the kids liked Mrs. Sterrett," Ben said, and was alarmed to realize that tears were now very close.
"Are you..."
"If she asks me if I'm all right one more time, I really am going to cry, I think. Or scream, or something."
He glanced at his watch and said, "I really have to run. Thanks for being so nice."
"Have a nice day, Mr. Hanscom."
"Sure, because tonight I die."
He tipped a finger her way and started back across the floor. Mr. Brockhill glanced up at him once, sharply and suspiciously. He looked up at the landing, which topped the left-hand staircase. The balloon still floated there, tied by its string to lacy wrought iron, but now the printing on its side read, "I killed Barbara Sterrett. Pennywise the Clown." He looked away, feeling the pulse in his throat starting to run again. He let himself out and was startled by sunlight. The clouds overhead were coming unraveled, and the warm late May sun was shafting down, making the grass look impossibly green and lush. Ben felt something start to lift from his heart. It seemed to him that he had left some insupportable burden behind in the library. And then he looked down at the book he had inadvertently withdrawn, and his teeth clamped together with sudden painful force. It was Bulldozer, by Stephen W. Meader, one of the books he had withdrawn from the library on the day he had dived into the Barrens to get away from Henry Bowers and his friends. And speaking of Henry, the track of his engineer boot was still on the book's cover. Shaking, fumbling at the pages, he turned to the back. The library had gone over to a microfilm checkout system. He had seen that. But there was still a pocket in the back of this book with a card tucked into it. There was a name written on each line of the card, followed by the librarian's return date stamp. Looking at the card, Ben saw this. Name of borrower, Charles N. Brown. Return by stamped date, May 14, 58. Name of borrower, David Hartwell. Return by stamped date, June 1, 58. Name of borrower, Joseph Brennan. Return by stamped date, June 17, 58. And on the last line of the card, his own childish signature, written in heavy pencil strokes, Benjamin Hanscom, July 9, 58. Stamped across this card, stamped across the book's flyleaf, stamped across the thickness of the pages, stamped again and again in a smeary red ink that looked like blood, was one word. Cancel.
"Oh, dear God," Ben murmured.
He did not know what else to say. That seemed to cover the entire situation.
"Oh, dear God, dear God."
He stood in the new sunlight, suddenly wondering what was happening to the others. 2. Eddie Kasprak makes a catch. Eddie got off the bus at the corner of Kansas Street and Kossuth Lane. Kossuth was a street that ran a quarter of a mile downhill before dead-ending abruptly where the crumbling earth sloped into the barrens. He had absolutely no idea why he had chosen this place to leave the bus. Kossuth Lane meant nothing to him, and he had known no one on this particular section of Kansas Street. But it seemed like the right place. That was all he knew. But at this point it seemed to be enough. Beverly had climbed off the bus with a little wave at one of the lower Main Street stops. Mike had taken his car back to the library. Now, watching the small and somehow absurd Mercedes bus pull away, he wondered exactly what he was doing here, standing on an obscure street corner in an obscure town nearly 500 miles away from Myra, who was undoubtedly worried to tears about him. He felt an instant of almost painful vertigo, touched his jacket pocket, and remembered that he had left his Dramamine back at the townhouse along with the rest of his pharmacopoeia. He had aspirin, though. He would no more have gone out sans aspirin than he would have gone out sans pants. He chugged a couple dry and began to walk along Kansas Street, thinking vaguely that he might go to the public library or perhaps cross over to Costello Avenue. It was beginning to clear now, and he supposed he could even walk across to West Broadway and admire the old Victorian houses that stood there, along with the only two really handsome residential blocks in Derry. He used to do that sometimes when he was a kid, just walk along West Broadway, sort of casual, like he was on his way to somewhere else. There was the Mueller's, near the corner of Wycham and West Broadway, a red house with turrets on either side and hedges in front. The Mueller's had a gardener who always looked at Eddie with suspicious eyes until he had passed on his way. Then there was the Bowie's house, which was four down from the Mueller's on the same side. One of the reasons he supposed that Greta Bowie and Sally Mueller had been such great friends in grammar school. It was green-shingled and also had turrets. But while the turrets on the Mueller's house were squared off, those on the Bowie's house were capped with funny cone-shaped things that looked to Eddie like squatty dunce caps. In the summer there was always lawn furniture on the side lawn, a table with a sporty yellow umbrella over it, wicker chairs, a rope hammock stretched between two trees. There was always a croquet game set up out back, too. Eddie knew this, although he had never been invited over to Greta's house to play croquet. Walking by casually, like he was on his way to somewhere else, Eddie would sometimes hear the click of the balls, laughter, groans as someone's ball was sent away. Once he had seen Greta herself, a lemonade in one hand and her croquet mallet in the other, looking slim and pretty beyond the words of all the poets. Even her sunburned shoulders seemed wonderfully pretty to Eddie Kasprack, who had at that time been 9. Going after her ball, which had been sent away. It had ricocheted off a tree and had thus brought Greta into Eddie's view. He fell in love with her a little that day, her shining blonde hair falling to the shoulders of her culotte dress, which was a cool blue. She glanced around, and for a moment he thought she had seen him, but that proved not to be so, because when he raised his hand in a timid hello, she did not raise hers in return, but only whacked her ball back onto the rear lawn and then ran after it. He had walked on with no resentment at the unreturned hello. He genuinely believed she must not have seen him, or at the fact that he had never been invited to attend one of the Saturday afternoon croquet games. Why would a beautiful girl like Greta Bowie want to invite a kid like him? He was thin-chested, asthmatic, and had the face of a drowned water rat. Yeah, he thought, walking aimlessly back down Kansas Street. I should have gone over to West Broadway and looked at all those houses again. The Mueller's, the Bowie's, Dr. Hale's place, the Tracker's. His thoughts broke off abruptly at that last name because, speak of the devil, here he was, standing in front of Tracker Brothers Truck Depot. Still right here, Eddie said aloud and laughed. Son of a gun. The house on West Broadway, which belonged to Phil and Tony Tracker, a pair of lifelong bachelors, was probably the loveliest of the large houses on that street, a spotlessly white mid-Victorian with green lawns and great beds of flowers that rioted, in a neatly landscaped way, of course, all the spring and summer long. Their driveway was freshly sealed each fall so that it always remained as black as a dark mirror. The slate shingles on the many slants of the roof were always a perfect mint green that almost exactly matched the lawn. And people sometimes stopped to take pictures of the mullioned windows, which were very old and quite remarkable. Any two men who bother keeping a house so nice must be queers, Eddie's mother had once said in a disgruntled sort of way. And Eddie hadn't dared ask for clarification. The truck depot was the exact opposite of the Tracker house on West Broadway.
It was a low brick structure. The bricks were old and crumbling in places, their dirty orange hue shading to a sooty black at the building's footings. The windows were uniformly filthy except for a small circular place on one of the lower panes of the starter's office. This one pane had been kept spotlessly clean by kids before Eddie and those who came after, because the starter kept a Playboy calendar over his desk. No boy came to play scratch baseball in the back lot without first stopping to wipe at the glass with his ball glove and examine that month's pinup. The depot was surrounded by a waste of gravel on three sides. Long-distance haulers, Jimmy Peets and Kenworths and Rios, all painted with the words Tracker Brothers. Derry, Newton, Providence, Hartford, New York, sometimes stood here in tangled, disordered profusion. Sometimes they were put together and sometimes they were just cabs or body boxes, standing silent on their rear wheels and support struts. The brothers kept their trucks out of the lot at the back of the building as much as they could because they were both avid baseball fans and liked the kids to come and play. Phil Tracker drove freight himself, so the boys rarely saw him, but Tony Tracker, a man with huge slab arms and a gut to match, kept the books and the accounts, and Eddie, who never played, his mother would have killed him if she had heard he was playing baseball, racing around and getting dust in his delicate lungs, risking broken legs, concussions, and God alone knew what else, got used to seeing him. He was a summer fixture, his voice as much a part of the game to Eddie then as Mel Allen's later became. Tony Tracker, large but somehow ghost-like, his white shirt glimmering as summer dusk drew down and fireflies began to loom the air with their lace of lights, yelling, "You've got to get under that ball before you can catch it, Red. You took your eye off in the ball, half-plank. You can't hit the goddamn thing if you ain't looking at it. Slide, horsefoot. You get the soles of them kids in that second baseman's face, he ain't never gonna tag you out." Never called any of them by name, Eddie remembered. It was always, "Hey Red, hey Blondie, hey Four Eyes, hey Half Pint." It was never a ball, it was always a ball. It was never a bat, it was always something Tony Tracker called an ash handle, as in, "You ain't never gonna hit that ball if you don't choke up on the ash handle, horsefoot." Grinning, Eddie walked a little closer. And then the grin faded. The long brick building where orders had been processed, trucks repaired, and goods stored on a short-term basis was now dark and silent. Weeds were growing up through the gravel, and there were no trucks in either side yard. Only a single box, its sides rusty and dull. Getting closer still, he saw that there was a Realtor's for sale sign in the window. Tracker's out of business, he thought, and was surprised at the sadness the thought carried with it, as if someone had died. He was glad now he hadn't walked over to West Broadway. If Tracker Brothers could have gone under, Tracker Brothers, which had seemed eternal, what might have happened on that street he had liked so much to walk down as a kid? He realized uneasily that he didn't want to know. He didn't want to see Greta Bowie with gray in her hair, her hips and legs thickened with much sitting and much eating and much drinking. It was better, safer, to just stay away. That's what we all should have done, just stayed away. We've got no business here. Coming back to where you grew up is like doing some crazy yoga trick, putting your feet in your own mouth and somehow swallowing yourself so there's nothing left. It can't be done, and any sane person ought to be fucking glad it can't. What do you suppose happened to Tony and Phil Tracker anyway? A heart attack for Tony, perhaps. He had been carrying maybe 75 extra pounds of meat on his bones. You had to watch out for what your heart might be up to. The poets might romance about broken hearts and Barry Manilow sing about them, and that was fine by Eddie. He and Myra had every album Barry Manilow had ever recorded. But he himself preferred a good solid EKG every year. Sure, Tony's heart had probably given it up as a bad job. And Phil? Bad luck on the highway, maybe. Eddie, who made his living behind the wheel himself, or had, these days he only drove the celebs and spent the rest of his time driving a desk, knew about bad luck on the highway. Old Phil might have jackknifed a rig somewhere in New Hampshire or in the Haynesville woods up north in Maine when the going was icy, or maybe he had lost his brakes on some long hill south of Derry, heading into Haven in a driving springtime rain. Those things, or any of the others you heard in those shit-kicking country songs about truck drivers who wore Stetson hats and had cheating on their minds.
Driving a desk was sometimes lonely, but Eddie had been in the driver's seat himself more than once, his aspirator riding there with him on the dashboard, its trigger reflected ghostly in the windshield, and a bucket load of pills in the glove compartment. And he knew that real loneliness was a smeary red. The color of the taillights of the car ahead of you reflected on wet hot top in a driving rain.
Oh, shit, the time goes by, Eddie Kasprak said, in a sighing sort of whisper, and was not even aware that he had spoken aloud.
Feeling both mellow and unhappy, a state more common to him than he ever would have believed, Eddie skirted the building, Gucci loafers crunching in the gravel, to look at the lot where the baseball games had been played when he was a kid, when it seemed 90% of the world had been made up of kids. The lot wasn't much changed, but a look was enough to convince him beyond doubt that the games had stopped, a tradition that had simply died out at some point in the years between, for reasons of its own. In 1958, the diamond shape of the infield had been defined not by limed base paths, but in ruts made by running feet. They had no actual bases, those boys who had played baseball here, boys who were all older than the losers, although Eddie remembered now that Stan Urs had sometimes played. His batting was only fair, but in the outfield he could run fast and he had the reflexes of an angel. But four pieces of dirty canvas were always kept under the loading bay behind the long brick building to be ceremonially taken out when enough kids had drifted into the back lot to play ball, and just as ceremonially returned when the shades of evening had fallen thickly enough to end further play. Standing here now, Eddie could see no trace of those rutted base paths. Weeds had grown up through the gravel in patchy profusion. Broken soda and beer bottles twinkled here and there. In the old days, such shards of broken glass had been religiously removed. The only thing that was the same was the chain-link fence at the back of the lot, 12 feet high and as rusty as dried blood. It framed the sky in droves of diamond shapes. That was home run territory, Eddie thought, standing bemused with his hands in his pockets at the place where home plate had been 27 years ago. Over the fence and down into the barrens, they used to call it the automatic. He laughed out loud and then looked around nervously, as if it were a ghost who had laughed out loud instead of a guy in $60 slacks, a guy as solid as, well, as solid as...
Get off it, Eds, Richie's voice seemed to whisper. You ain't solid at all. And in the last few years, the chucks have been few and far between, right?
Yeah, right, Eddie said in a low voice, and kicked a few loose stones away in a rattle.
In truth, he had only seen two balls go over the fence at the back of the lot behind Tracker Brothers, both of them hit by the same kid, Belch Huggins. Belch had been almost comically big, already 6 feet tall at 12, weighing maybe 170. He had gotten his nickname because he was able to articulate belches of amazing length and loudness. At his best, he sounded like a cross between a bullfrog and a cicada. Sometimes he would pat a hand rapidly across his open mouth while belching, emitting a sound like a horse Indian. Belch had been big and not really fat, Eddie remembered now, but it was as if God had never really intended for a boy of 12 to attain such remarkable size. If he had not died that summer, he might have grown to 6'6 or better, and might have learned along the way how to maneuver his outsized body through a world of smaller denizens. He might even, Eddie thought, have learned gentleness. But at 12 he had been both clumsy and mean, not retarded but almost seeming so because all his body's actions seemed so amazingly graceless and lunging. He had none of Stanley's built-in rhythms. It was as if Belch's body did not talk to his brain at all, but existed in its own cosmos of slow thunder. Eddie could remember the evening a long, slow fly ball had been hit directly to Belch's position in the outfield. Belch didn't even have to move. He stood looking up, raised his glove in an almost aimless punching gesture, and instead of settling into his glove, the ball had struck him squarely on top of the head, producing a hollow bonk sound. It was as if the ball had been dropped from 3 stories up onto the roof of a Ford sedan. It bounced up a good 4 feet and came down neatly into Belch's glove. An unfortunate kid named Owen Phillips had laughed at that bonking sound. Belch had walked over to him and had kicked his ass so hard that the Phillips kid had run screaming for home with a hole in the seat of his pants. No one else laughed, at least not on the outside. Eddie supposed that if Richie Tozier had been there, he wouldn't have been able to help it, and Belch probably would have put him in the hospital. Belch was similarly slow at the plate.
He was easy to strike out, and if he hit a grounder, even the most fumble-fingered infielders had no trouble throwing him out at first. But when he got all of one, it went a long, long way. The two balls that he had seen Belch hit over the fence had both been wonders. The first had never been recovered, although more than a dozen boys had tramped back and forth over the steeply slanting slope which plunged down into the barrens looking for it. The second, however, had been recovered. The ball belonged to another sixth grader. Eddie could not now remember what his real name had been, only that all the other kids called him Snuffy because he always had a cold, and had been in use for most of the late spring and early summer of 58. As a result, it was no longer the nearly perfect spherical creation of white horsehide and red stitching that it had been when it came out of the box. It was scuffed, grass-stained, and cut in several places by its hundreds of bouncing trips over the gravel in the outfield. Its stitching was beginning to come unraveled in one place, and Eddie, who shagged foul balls when his asthma wasn't too bad, relishing every casual, "Thanks, kid," when he threw the ball back to the playing field, knew that soon someone would produce a roll of black cat friction tape and embalm it so they could get another week or so out of it. But before that day came, a seventh grader with the unlikely name of Stringer Dedham tossed what he fancied a change of speed pitch to Belch Huggins. Belch timed the pitch perfectly. The slow ones were, you should pardon the pun, just his speed. And hit Snuffy's elderly Spaulding so hard that the cover came right off and fluttered down just a few feet shy of second base like a big white moth. The ball itself had continued up and up into a gorgeous twilight sky, unraveling and unraveling as it went. Kids turning to follow its progress in dumb wonder. Up and over the chain-link fence it went, still rising. And Eddie remembered Stringer Dedham had said, "Holy shit," in a soft and awestruck voice as it went, riding a track into the sky. And they had all seen the unwinding string, and maybe even before it hit, six boys had been monkeying up that fence, and Eddie could remember Tony Tracker laughing in an amazed, loon-like way and crying, "That one would have been out of Yankee Stadium. Do you hear me? That one would have been out of fucking Yankee Stadium." It had been Peter Gordon who found the ball, not far from the stream the Losers' Club would dam up less than 3 weeks later. What was left was not even 3 inches through the center. It was some kind of cockeyed miracle that the twine had never broken. By unspoken consent, the boys had brought the remains of Snuffy's ball back to Tony Tracker, who examined it without saying a word, surrounded by boys who were likewise silent. Seen from a distance, that circle of boys standing around the tall man with the big sloping belly might have seemed almost religious in its intent. The veneration of a holy object. Belch Huggins had not even run around the bases. He only stood among the others like a boy who had no precise idea of where he was. What Tony Tracker handed him that day was smaller than a tennis ball. Eddie, lost in these memories, walked from the place where home had been, across the pitcher's mound. Only it had never been a mound. It had been a depression from which the gravel had been scraped clean, and out into shortstop country. He paused briefly, struck by the silence, and then strolled on out to the chain-link fence. It was rustier than ever, and overgrown by some sort of ugly climbing vine, but still there. Looking through it, he could see how the ground sloped away, aggressively green. The barrens were more jungle-like than ever, and for the first time he found himself wondering why a stretch of such tangled and virulent growth should have been called the barrens at all. It was many things, but barren was not one of them. Why not the wilderness or the jungle? Barrens. It had an ominous, almost sinister sound, but what it conjured up in the mind were not tangles of shrubs and trees so thick they had to fight for sun space. It called up pictures of sand dunes shifting away endlessly, or gray-slate expanses of hardpan and desert. Barren. Mike had said earlier that they were all barren, and it seemed true enough. Seven of them, and not a kid among them. Even in these days of Planned Parenthood, that was bucking the odds. He looked through the rusty diamond shapes, hearing the faraway drone of cars on Kansas Street, the faraway trickle and rush of water down below. He could see glints of it in the spring sunshine, like flashes of glass. The bamboo stands were still down there, looking unhealthily white, like patches of fungus in all the green. Beyond them, in the marshy stretches of ground bordering the Kanduskeag, there was supposed to have been quick mud. "I spent the happiest times of my childhood down there in that mess," he thought, and shivered. He was about to turn away when something else caught his eye.
a cement cylinder with a heavy steel cap on the top. Morlock holes, Ben used to call them, laughing with his mouth, but not quite laughing with his eyes. If you went over to one, it would stand maybe waist high on you, if you were a kid. And you would see the words, Derry Department of Public Works, stamped in raised metal in a semicircle. And you could hear a humming noise from deep inside. Some sort of machinery. Morlock holes. That's where we went. In August, in the end. We went into one of Ben's Morlock holes, into the sewers. But after a while, they weren't sewers anymore. They were what? Patrick Hockstetter was down there. Before it took him, Beverly saw him doing something bad. It made her laugh, but she knew it was bad. Something to do with Henry Bowers, wasn't it? Yes, I think so, and... He turned away suddenly and started back toward the abandoned depot, not wanting to look down into the barrens anymore, not liking the thoughts they conjured up. He wanted to be home with Myra. He didn't want to be here. Catch, kid! He turned toward the sound of the voice, and here came some sort of a ball right over the fence and toward him. It struck the gravel and bounced. Eddie stuck out his hand and caught it. In his unthinking reflex, the catch was so neat it was almost elegant. He looked down at what was in his hand, and everything inside him went cool and loose. Once it had been a baseball. Now it was only a string-wrapped sphere, because the cover had been knocked off. He could see the string trailing away. It went over the top of the fence like a strand of spider web and disappeared into the barrens. Oh, Jesus, he thought. Oh, Jesus, it's here. It's here with me, now. Come on down and play, Eddie, the voice on the other side of the fence said. And Eddie realized with a fainting sort of horror that it was the voice of Belch Huggins, who had been murdered in the tunnels under Derry in August of 1958. And now here was the Belch himself, struggling up and over the bank on the other side of the fence. He wore a pinstriped New York Yankees baseball uniform that was flecked with bits of autumn leaves and smeared with green. He was Belch, but he was also the leper, a creature hideously arisen from long years in a wet grave. The flesh of his heavy face hung in putrescent strings and runners. One eye socket was empty. Things squirmed in his hair. He wore a moss-slimed baseball glove on one hand. He poked the rotting fingers of his right hand through the diamonds of the chain-link fence, and when he curled them, Eddie heard a dreadful squirting sound which he thought might drive him mad.
That one would have been out of Yankee Stadium, Belch said and grinned.
A toad, noxiously white and squirming, dropped from his mouth and tumbled to the ground.
Do you hear me? That one would have been out of fucking Yankee Stadium. And by the way, Eddie, do you want a blowjob? I'll do it for a dime. Hell, I'll do it for free.
Belch's face changed. The jelly-like bulb of nose fell in, revealing two raw red channels that Eddie had seen in his dreams. His hair coarsened and drew back from his temples, turned cobweb white. The rotting skin on his forehead split open, revealing white bone covered with a mucousy substance, like the bleared lens of a searchlight. Belch was gone. The thing which had been under the porch at 29 Niebold Street was here now.
Bobby blows me for a dime, it crooned, beginning to climb the fence.
It left little pieces of its flesh in the diamond shapes the crisscrossing wires made. The fence jingled and rattled with its weight. When it touched the climbing, vine-like weeds, they turned black.
He will do it any time. 15 cents for overtime.
Eddie tried to scream. Nothing but a dry, senseless squeak came out of him. His lungs felt like the world's oldest ocarinas. He looked down at the ball in his hand, and suddenly blood began to sweat up from between the wrapped strings. It pattered to the gravel and splashed on his loafers. He threw it down and took two lurching stagger steps backward, his eyes bulging from his face, rubbing his hands on the front of his shirt. The leper had reached the top of the fence. Its head swayed in silhouette against the sky, a nightmare shaped like a bloated Halloween jack-o'-lantern. Its tongue lolled out, 4 feet long, perhaps six. It twined its way down the fence like a snake from the leper's grinning mouth. There 1 second, gone the next. It did not fade like a ghost in a movie. It simply winked out of existence. But Eddie heard a sound which confirmed its essential solidity. A pop sound, like a cork blowing out of a champagne bottle. It was the sound of air rushing in to fill the place where the leper had been. He turned and began to run, but before he had gone 10 feet, four stiff shapes flew out from the shadows under the loading bay of the abandoned brick depot. He thought at first they were bats, and he screamed and covered his head. Then he saw that they were squares of canvas, the squares of canvas that had been the bases when the big kids played here.
They whirled and twirled in the still air. He had to duck to avoid one of them. They settled in their accustomed places all at once, kicking up little puffs of grit. Home, first, second, third. Gasping, his breath short in his throat, Eddie ran past home plate, his lips drawn back, his face as white as cottage cheese. Whack! The sound of a bat hitting a phantom ball. And then... Eddie stopped, the strength going out of his legs, a groan passing his lips. The ground was bulging in a straight line from home to first, as if a gigantic gopher was tunneling rapidly just below the surface of the ground. Gravel rolled off to either side. The shape under the earth reached the base and the canvas flipped up into the air. It went up so hard and fast it made a popping sound, the sound a shoeshine kid makes when he's feeling good and pops the rag. The ground began to ridge between first and second, racing and racing. Second base flew into the air with a similar popping sound and had barely settled back before the shape under the ground had reached third and was racing for home. Home plate flew up as well. But before it could come down, the thing had popped out of the ground like some grisly party favor. And the thing was Tony Tracker. His face a skull to which a few blackened chunks of flesh still clung, his white shirt a mess of rotted linen strings. He poked out of the earth at home plate from the waist up, swaying back and forth like a grotesque worm.
"Don't matter how much you choke up on that ash handle," Tony Tracker said in a gritty, grinding voice. Exposed teeth grinned in lunatic chumminess. "Don't matter, Wheezy. We'll get you. We and your friends. We'll have a ball."
Eddie shrieked and staggered away. There was a hand on his shoulder. He shrank away from it. The hand tightened for a moment, then gave way. He turned. It was Greta Bowie. She was dead. Half of her face was gone. Maggots crawled in the churned red meat that was left. She held a green balloon in one hand.
"Car crash,"
the recognizable half of her mouth said and grinned. The grin caused an unspeakable ripping sound, and Eddie could see raw tendons moving like terrible straps.
"I was 18, Eddie. Drunk and done up on reds. Your friends are here, Eddie."
Eddie backed away from her, his hands held up in front of his face. She walked toward him. Blood had splashed, then dried on her legs in long splotches. She was wearing penny loafers. And now beyond her, he saw the ultimate horror. Patrick Hockstetter was shambling toward him across the outfield. He too was wearing a New York Yankees uniform. Eddie ran. Greta clutched at him again, tearing his shirt and spilling some terrible liquid down the back of his collar. Tony Tracker was pulling himself out of his man-sized gopher run. Patrick Hockstetter stumbled and staggered. Eddie ran, not knowing where he was finding the breath to run, but running somehow anyway. And as he ran, he saw words floating in front of him, the words that had been printed on the side of the green balloon Greta Bowie had been holding. "Asthma medicine causes lung cancer. Compliments of Center Street Drug." Eddie ran. He ran and ran, and at some point he collapsed in a dead faint near McCarran Park, and some kids saw him and steered clear of him because he looked like a wino to them, like he might have some kind of weird disease for all they knew. He might even be the killer, and they talked about reporting him to the police, but in the end they didn't. 3. Bev Rogan pays a call. Beverly walked absently down Main Street from the Derry townhouse, where she had gone to change into a pair of blue jeans and a bright yellow smock blouse. She was not thinking about where she was going. Instead, she thought this: "Your hair is winter fire, January embers. My heart burns there, too." She had hidden that in her bottom drawer beneath her underwear. Her mother might have seen it, but that was all right. The important thing was, that was one drawer her father never looked in. If he had seen it, he might have looked at her with that bright, almost friendly, and utterly paralyzing stare of his, and asked in his almost friendly way, "You been doing something you shouldn't be doing, Bev? You been doing something with some boy?" And if she said yes, or if she said no, there would be a quick wham-bam, so quick and so hard it didn't even hurt at first. It took a few seconds for the vacuum to dissipate and the pain to fill the place where the vacuum had been. Then his voice again, almost friendly. "I worry a lot about you, Beverly. I worry an awful lot. You've got to grow up, isn't that so?" Her father might still be living here in Derry. He had been living here the last time she had heard from him, but that had been, how long ago? 10 years? Long before she had married Tom, anyway. She had gotten a postcard from him, not a plain postcard like the one the poem had been written on,
but one showing the hideous plastic statue of Paul Bunyan, which stood in front of City Center. The statue had been erected sometime in the 50s, and it had been one of the landmarks of her childhood, but her father's card had called up no nostalgia or memories for her. It might as well have been a card showing Gateway Arch in St. Louis or the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. "Hope you are doing well and being good," the card read. "Hope you will send me something if you can, as I don't have much. I love you, Bevy. Dad." He had loved her, and in some ways she supposed that had everything to do with why she had fallen so desperately in love with Bill Denbrough that long summer of 1958. Because of all the boys, Bill was the one who projected the sense of authority she associated with her father. But it was a different sort of authority, somehow. It was authority that listened. She saw no assumption in either his eyes or his actions that he believed her father's kind of worrying to be the only reason authority needed to exist, as if people were pets to be cosseted and disciplined. Whatever the reasons, by the end of their first meeting as a complete group in July of that year, that meeting of which Bill had taken such complete and effortless charge, she had been madly head over heels in love with him. Calling it a simple schoolgirl crush was like saying a Rolls-Royce was a vehicle with four wheels, something like a hay wagon. She did not giggle wildly and blush when she saw him, nor did she chalk his name on trees or write it on the walls of the kissing bridge. She simply lived with his face in her heart all the time, a kind of sweet, hurtful ache. She would have died for him. It was natural enough, she supposed, for her to want to believe it had been Bill who sent her the love poem, although she had never gotten so far gone as to actually convince herself it was so. No, she had known who wrote the poem. And later on, at some point, hadn't its author admitted this to her? Yes, Ben had told her so, although she could not now remember, not for the life of her, just when or under what circumstances he had actually said it out loud. And although his love for her had been almost as well hidden as the love she had felt for Bill. "But you told him, Bevy. You did. You told him you loved." It was obvious to anyone who really looked, and who was kind. It was in the way he was always careful to keep some space between them, in the draw of his breath when she touched his arm or his hand, in the way he dressed when he knew he was going to see her. Dear sweet fat Ben. It had ended somehow, that difficult pre-adolescent triangle, but just how it had ended was one of the things she still couldn't remember. She thought that Ben had confessed authoring and sending the little love poem. She thought she had told Bill she loved him, that she would love him forever. And somehow, those two tellings had helped save all of their lives. Or had they? She couldn't remember. These memories, or memories of memories, that was really closer to what they were like islands that were not really islands at all, but only knobs of a single coral spine which happened to poke up above the waterline, not separate at all, but one piece. Yet whenever she tried to dive deep and see the rest, a maddening image intervened. The grackles which came back each spring to New England, crowding the telephone lines, trees, and rooftops, jostling for places and filling the thawing late March air with their raucous gossip. This image came to her again and again, foreign and disturbing, like a heavy radio beam that blankets the signal you really want to pick up. She realized with sudden shock that she was standing outside of the clean clothes washateria, where she and Stan Uris and Ben and Eddie had taken the rags that day in late June, rags stained with blood which only they could see. The windows were now soaped opaque, and there was a hand-lettered "For Sale by Owner" sign taped to the door. Peering between the swashes of soap, she could see an empty room with lighter squares of dirty yellow walls where the washers had stood. "I'm going home," she thought dismally, but walked on anyway. This neighborhood hadn't changed much. A few more of the trees were gone, probably elms felled by disease. The houses looked a little tackier. Broken windows seemed slightly more common than they had been when she was a girl. Some of the broken panes had been replaced with cardboard, some hadn't. And here she stood in front of the apartment house, 127 Lower Main Street. Still here. The peeling white she remembered had become a peeling chocolate brown at some point during the years between, but it was still unmistakable. There was the window which looked in on what had been their kitchen. There was the window of her bedroom. "Jim Doyen, you come out of that road. Come out right now. You want to get run over and killed?" She shivered, hugging her arms across her breasts in an X, cupping her elbows in her palms. Daddy could still be living here. Oh, yes, he could. He wouldn't move unless he had to. Just walk on up there, Beverly. Look at the mailboxes. Three boxes for three apartments, just like in the old days. And if there's one which says Marsh, you can ring the bell, and pretty soon there'll be the shuffle of slippers down the hall, and the door will open, and you can look at him. The man whose sperm made you red-headed and left-handed and gave you the ability to draw. Remember how he used to draw? He could draw anything he wanted. If he felt like it, that is. He didn't feel like it often. I guess he had too many things to worry about. But when he did, you used to sit for hours and watch while he drew cats and dogs and horses and cows with moo coming out of their mouths in balloons. You'd laugh and he'd laugh, and then he'd say, "Now you, Bevy." And when you held the pen, he'd guide your hand, and you'd see the cow or the cat or the smiling man unspooling beneath your own fingers while you smelled his men and skin bracer in the warmth of his skin. Go on up, Beverly. Ring the bell. He'll come and he'll be old. The lines will be drawn deep in his face and his teeth. Those that are left will be yellow. And he'll look at you and he'll say, "Why, it's Bevy. Bevy's come home to see her old dad. Come on in, Bevy. I'm so glad to see you. I'm glad because I worry about you, Bevy. I worry a lot." She walked slowly up the path, and the weeds growing up between the cracked concrete sections brushed at the legs of her jeans. She looked closely at the first floor windows, but they were curtained off. She looked at the mailboxes. Third floor, Starkweather. Second floor, Burke. First floor, her breath caught, Marsh. "But I won't ring. I don't want to see him. I won't ring the bell." This was a firm decision at last. The decision that opened the gate to a full and useful lifetime of firm decisions. She walked down the path, back to downtown, up to the Derry townhouse. Packed, cabbed, flew, told Tom to bug out, lived successfully, died happily. Rang the bell. She heard the familiar chimes from the living room, chimes that had always sounded to her like a Chinese name, Ching Chong. Silence. No answer. She shifted on the porch from one foot to the other, suddenly needing to pee. "No one home," she thought, relieved. "I can go now." Instead, she rang again. Ching Chong. No answer. She thought of Ben's lovely little poem and tried to remember exactly when and how he had confessed its authorship, and why, for a brief second, it called up an association with having her first menstrual period. Had she begun menstruating at 11? Surely not, although her breasts had begun their first achy growth around midwinter. Why? Then, intervening, a mental picture of thousands of grackles on phone lines and rooftops, all babbling at a white spring sky. "I'll leave now. I've run twice. That's enough." But she rang again. Ching Chong. Now she heard someone approaching, and the sound was just as she had imagined, a tired whisper of old slippers. She looked around wildly and came very, very close to just taking to her heels. Could she make it down the cement walk and around the corner, leaving her father to think it had been nothing but kids playing pranks? "Hey, mister, you got Prince Albert in a can?" She let out a sudden sharp breath and had to tighten her throat because what wanted to come out was a laugh of relief. It wasn't her father at all. Standing in the doorway and looking out at her was a tall woman in her late 70s. Her hair was long and gorgeous, mostly white, but shot through with loads of purest gold. Behind her rimless spectacles were eyes as blue as the water and the fjords her ancestors had perhaps hailed from. She wore a purple dress of watered silk. It was shabby but still dignified. Her wrinkled face was kind. "Yes, miss?" "I'm sorry," Beverly said. The urge to laugh had passed as swiftly as it had come. She noticed that the old woman wore a cameo at her throat. It was almost certainly real ivory, surrounded by a band of gold so thin it was nearly invisible. "I must have rung the wrong bell." "Or rang the wrong bell on purpose," her mind whispered. "I meant to ring for Marsh."
"Marsh?" Her forehead wrinkled delicately.
"Yes, you see..."
"There's no Marsh here," the old woman said.
"But unless...
You don't mean Alvin Marsh, do you?"
"Yes," Beverly said. "My father."
The old woman's hand rose to the cameo and touched it. She peered more closely at Beverly, making her feel ridiculously young, as if she should perhaps have a box of Girl Scout cookies in her hands, or maybe some tags, support the Derry High School Tigers. Then the old woman smiled, a kind smile that was nonetheless sad.
Why, you have fallen out of touch, miss. I don't want to be the one who tells you this, a stranger, but your father has been dead these last 5 years.
But on the bell.
She looked again and uttered a small, bewildered sound that was not quite a laugh. In her agitation, in her subconscious but rock-solid certainty that her old man would still be here, she had read Kirsch as Marsh.
You're Mrs. Kirsch? She asked.
She was staggered by this news of her father, but she also felt stupid about the mistake. The lady would think her little more than illiterate.
Mrs. Kirsch, she agreed.
Did you know my dad?
Very little did I know him, Mrs. Kirsch said. She sounded a little like Yoda in The Empire Strikes Back, and Beverly felt like laughing again.
When had her emotions gone whipsawing so violently back and forth?
The truth was she couldn't remember a time,
but she was dismally afraid she would before much longer.
He rented the ground floor apartment before me. We saw each other, me coming and him going, over a space of a few days. He moved down to Roward Lane. Do you know it?
Yes, Beverly said.
Roward Lane branched off from Lower Main Street 4 blocks farther down, where the apartment buildings were smaller and even more desperately shabby.
I used to see him at the Costello Avenue Market sometimes, Mrs. Kirsch said, and at the Washateria before they closed it. We passed a word from time to time. Girl, you're pale. I'm sorry. Come in and let me give you tea.
No, I couldn't, Beverly said weakly.
But in fact, she actually felt pale, like clouded glass that you could nearly look through. She could use tea and a chair in which to sit and drink it.
You could and you will, Mrs. Kirsch said warmly. It's the least I can do for having told you such unpleasant news.
Before she could protest, Beverly found herself being led up the gloomy hall and into her old apartment, which now seemed much smaller, but safe enough. Safe, she supposed, because almost everything was different. Instead of the pink-topped formica table with its 3 chairs, there was a small round table, really not much bigger than an end table, with silk flowers and a pottery vase. Instead of the old Kelvinator refrigerator with the round drum on top, her father tinkered with it constantly to keep it going, there was a copper-colored Frigidaire. The stove was small but efficient-looking. There was an Amana radar range above it. Bright blue curtains hung in the windows, and she could see flower boxes outside them. The floor, linoleum when she was a girl here, had been stripped to its original wood. Many applications of oil made it glow mellowly. Mrs. Kirsch looked around from the stove where she was placing a teapot.
You grew up here?
Yes, Beverly said. But it's very different now, so trim and tidy.
Wonderful. How kind you are, Mrs. Kirsch said,
and her smile made her younger. It was radiant.
I have a little money, you see. Not much, but with my Social Security I am comfortable. Once I was a girl in Sweden. I came to this country in 1920, a girl of 14 with no money. Which is the best way to learn the value of money, would you agree?
Yes, Bev said.
At the hospital I worked, Mrs. Kirsch said. Many years. From 1925 I worked there. I rose to the position of head housekeeper. All the keys I had. My husband invested our money quite well. Now I have reached a little harbor. Look around, miss, while the water boils.
No, I couldn't.
Please. Still, I feel guilty. Look, if you like.
And so she did look. Her parents' bedroom was now Mrs. Kirsch's bedroom, and the difference was profound. The room seemed brighter and airier now. A large cedar chest, the initials RG inlaid into it, breathed its gentle aroma into the air. A gigantic surprise quilt lay on the bed. On it she could see women drawing water, boys driving cattle, men building haystacks. A wonderful quilt. Her room had become a sewing room. A black Singer machine stood on a wrought iron table under a pair of starkly efficient tensor lamps. A picture of Jesus hung on one wall, a picture of John F. Kennedy on another. A beautiful brake front stood below the picture of JFK. It was filled with books instead of china, but seemed none the worse for that. She went into the bathroom last. It had been redone in a rose color that was too low and pleasant to seem gaudy. All of the fixtures were new, and yet she approached the basin feeling that the old nightmare had gripped her again. She would peer down into that black and lidless eye. The whispering would begin, and then the blood. She leaned over the sink, catching a glimpse of her pallid face and dark eyes in the mirror over the basin, And then she stared into that eye, waiting for the voices, the laughter, the groans, the blood. How long might she have stood there, bent over the sink, waiting for the sights and sounds 27 years gone, she didn't know. It was Mrs. Kirsch's voice that bid her return.
Tea, miss?
She jerked back, the semi-hypnosis broken, and left the bathroom. If there had been dark magic somewhere down in that drain, it was gone now, or was sleeping. Oh, you shouldn't have. Mrs. Kirsch looked up at her brightly, smiling a little.
Oh, miss, if you knew how seldom company calls these days, you'd not say so. Why, I put on more than this for the man from the Bangor Hydro who comes to read my meter. I'm making him fat.
Delicate cups and saucers stood on the round kitchen table, a clean bone white edged with blue. There was a plate of small cakes and cookies. Besides the sweets, a pewter teapot chuffed mild steam and pleasant fragrance. Bemused, Bev thought that the only things missing were the tiny sandwiches with the crusts cut off. Ant sandwiches, she'd thought them, always one word. Three main types of ant sandwiches. Cream cheese and olive, watercress, and egg salad.
Sit down, said Mrs. Kirsch. Sit down, miss, and I'll pour out.
I'm not a miss, Beverly said, and raised her left hand so that her ring would show. Mrs. Kirsch smiled and pushed a hand through the air.
Shaw, the gesture said. I call all the pretty young girls miss, she said. Just a habit. Don't take offense.
No, Beverly said, not at all. But for some reason she felt a feather touch of unease. There was something in the old woman's smile that had seemed a little... what? Unpleasant? False? Knowing? But that was ridiculous, wasn't it? I love what you've done to the place.
Do you?
Mrs. Kirsch said and poured out. The tea looked dark, muddy. Beverly wasn't sure she wanted to drink it. And suddenly she wasn't sure she wanted to be here at all.
It did say Marsh under the doorbell,
her mind whispered subtly, and she was frightened. Mrs. Kirsch passed her tea.
Thank you, Beverly said.
The look of it might have been muddy. The aroma, however, was wonderful. She tasted. It was fine.
Stop jumping at shadows, she told herself.
That cedar chest in particular is a wonderful piece.
An antique, that one,
Mrs. Kirsch said and laughed. Beverly noticed that the old woman's beauty was flawed on only one score, and that was common enough here in the Northlands. Her teeth were very bad, strong-looking, but bad all the same. They were yellow, and the front two had crossed each other. The canine seemed very long, almost like tusks.
They were white. When she came to the door, she smiled, and you thought to yourself how white they were.
Suddenly, she was not just a little frightened. Suddenly, she wanted,
needed,
to be away from here.
Very old, oh yes,
Mrs. Kirsch exclaimed, and drank her cup of tea off at a single gulp with a sudden shocking slurping sound. She smiled at Beverly, grinned at her, and Beverly saw that the woman's eyes had changed too. The corneas were now yellow, ancient, threaded with bleary stitches of red. Her hair was thinner, the braid looked malnourished, no longer silver shot with bright yellow but a dull gray.
Very old,
Mrs. Kirsch reminisced over her empty cup, looking slyly at Beverly from her yellowed eyes. Her snaggled teeth showed in that repulsive, almost leering grin.
From home with me it came. The RG carved into it, you noticed?
Yes.
Her voice came from far away, and a part of her brain yammered,
if she doesn't know you've seen the change, perhaps you're still all right. If she doesn't know, doesn't see.
My father, she said, pronouncing it fodder, and Beverly saw that her dress had also changed. It had become a scabrous, peeling black. The cameo was a skull, its jaw hung in a diseased gape.
His name was Robert Gray, better known as Bob Gray, better known as Pennywise the Dancing Clown, although that was not his name either. But he did love his joke, my father.
She laughed again. Some of her teeth had turned as black as her dress. The wrinkles in her skin now cut deep. Her milk-rose skin had gone a sickly yellow. Her fingers were claws. She grinned at Beverly.
Have something to eat, dear.
Her voice had risen half an octave, but the octave was cracked in this register, and her voice was the sound of a crypt door swinging mindlessly on hinges clogged with black earth.
No, thank you,
Beverly heard her mouth say in a child's high, oh, I must be going voice. The words did not seem to originate in her brain. Rather, they came out of her mouth and then had to travel around to her ears before she was aware of what she had said.
No?
The witch asked and grinned. Her claws scrabbled on the plate, and she began to cram thin molasses cookies and delicate frosted slices of cake into her mouth with both hands. Her horrid teeth plunged and reared. Her fingernails, long and dirty, dug into the sweets. Crumbs tumbled down the bony slab of her chin. Her breath was the smell of long dead things burst wide open by the gases of their own decay. Her laugh was now a dead cackle. Her hair was thinner. Scaly scalp showed in patches.
Oh, he loved his joke, my father. This is a joke, miss, if you enjoy them. My father bore me rather than my mother. He shat me from his asshole. Hee hee hee.
I ought to go, Beverly heard herself say in that same high, wounded voice. The voice of a small girl who has been viciously embarrassed at her first party. There was no strength in her legs. She was dimly aware that it was not tea in her cup, but shit, liquid shit, a little party favor from the sewers under the city. She had drunk some of that. Not much, but a sip. Oh, God, oh, blessed Jesus, please, please. The woman was shrinking before her eyes, thinning. It was now a crone with an apple doll's face who sat across from her, giggling in a high, squealing voice and rocking back and forth.
Oh, my father and I are one, she said. Just me, just him, and dear, if you are wise, you will run back to where you came from. Run quickly, because to stay will mean worse than your death. No one who dies in Derry really dies. You knew that before. Believe it now.
In slow motion, Beverly gathered her legs under her. As if from outside, she saw herself gaining her feet and backing away from the table and from the witch in an agony of horror and disbelief. Disbelief because she realized for the first time that the neat little dining room was not dark oak, but fudge. Even as she watched, the witch, still giggling, her ancient yellow eyes slanted slyly off into the corner of the room, broke a piece of it off and stuffed it avidly into the black ring trap that was her mouth. The cups, she saw, were white bark that had been carefully looped with blue-dyed frosting. The pictures of Jesus and John Kennedy were creations of nearly transparent sponge sugar, and as she looked at them, Jesus stuck out his tongue, and Kennedy dropped a stinky wink.
We're all waiting for you,
the witch screamed, and her fingernails scrabbled over the surface of the fudge table, drawing deep scars in its shining surface.
Oh, yes, oh, yes.
The overhead lights were globes of hard candy. The wainscoting was caramel taffy. She looked down and saw that her shoes were leaving prints on the floorboards, which were not boards at all, but slices of chocolate. The smell of candy was cloying.
Oh, God, it's Hansel and Gretel. It's the witch, the one that always scared me the worst because she ate the children. You and your friends,
the witch screamed, laughing.
You and your friends, in the cage until the oven's hot.
She screamed laughter, and Beverly ran for the door, but she ran as if in slow motion. The witch's laughter beat and swirled around her head, a cloud of bats. Beverly shrieked. The hall stank of sugar and nougat and toffee and sickening synthetic strawberries. The doorknob, mock crystal when she came in, was now a monstrous sugar diamond.
I worry about you, Bevy. I worry a lot.
She turned, swirls of red hair floating around her face, to see her father staggering toward her down the hallway, wearing the witch's black dress and skull cameo. Her father's face hung with doughy, running flesh, his eyes as black as obsidian, his hands clenching and unclenching, his mouth grinning with soupy fervor.
I beat you because I wanted to fuck you, Bevy. That's all I wanted to do. I wanted to fuck you. I wanted to eat you. I wanted to eat your pussy. I wanted to suck your clit up between my teeth. Yum, yum, Bevy. Oh, yummy in my tummy. I wanted to put you in the cage and get the oven hot and feel your cunt, your plump cunt. And when it was plump enough to eat, eat.
Screaming, she grasped the sticky doorknob and bolted out onto a porch that was decorated with praline doodads and floored with fudge. Far away, dim, seeming to swim in her vision, she saw cars passing back and forth and a woman pushing a cart full of groceries back from Costello's.
I have to get out of here, she thought, just barely coherent.
That's reality out there, if I can only get out to the sidewalk.
Won't do you any good to run, Bevy.
Her father, my father,
told her, laughing. We've waited a long time for this. This is going to be fun. This is going to be yummy in our tummies.
She looked back again, and now her dead father was not wearing the witch's black dress, but the clown suit with the big orange buttons. There was a 1958-style coonskin cap, the kind popularized by Fess Parker in the Disney movie about Davy Crockett, perched on its head. In one hand, it held a bunch of balloons. In the other, it held the leg of a child like a chicken drumstick. Written on each balloon was the legend, "It came from outer space."
"Tell your friends I am the last of a dying race," it said, grinning its sunken grin as it staggered and lurched down the porch steps after her. "The only survivor of a dying planet. I have come to rob all the women, rape all the men, and learn to do the peppermint twist."
It began to do a mad shuckin' jive, balloons in one hand, severed bleeding leg in the other. The clown costume writhed and flapped, but Beverly felt no wind. Her legs tangled in each other and she spilled to the pavement, throwing out her palms to take up the shock, which went all the way up to her shoulders. The woman pushing the grocery cart paused and looked back doubtfully, then hurried on a little faster. The clown came toward her again, casting the severed leg aside. It landed on the lawn with an indescribable thud. Beverly only lay sprawled on the pavement for a moment, sure somewhere inside that she must wake soon. This couldn't be real. Had to be a dream. She realized that wasn't true a moment before the clown's crooked, long-clawed fingers touched her. It was real. It could kill her, as it had killed the children. "The Grackles know your real name," she screamed at it suddenly. It recoiled, and it seemed to her that for a moment the grin on the lips inside the great red grin that had been painted on and around them became a grimace of hate and pain, and perhaps of fear as well. It might only have been her imagination, and she certainly had no idea why she had said such a crazy thing, but it bought her an instant of time. She was on her feet and running. Brakes squealed, and a hoarse voice, both mad and scared, yelled, "Why don't you look where you're going, you dumb quiff?" She had a blurred impression of the bakery truck that had almost hit her when she bolted into the street like a child after a rubber ball, and then she was standing on the opposite sidewalk, panting, a hot stitch in her left side. The bakery truck went on down Lower Main. The clown was gone. The leg was gone. The house still stood there, but she saw now that it was crumbling and deserted. The windows boarded up, the steps leading up to the porch cracked and broken. Was I really in there, or did I dream it all? But her jeans were dirty, her yellow blouse smeared with dust, and there was chocolate on her fingers. She rubbed them on the legs of her jeans and walked away fast, her face hot, her back cold as ice, her eyeballs seeming to pulse in and out with the rapid thud of her heart. "We can't beat it. Whatever it is, we can't beat it. It even wants us to try. It wants to settle the old score. Can't be happy with a draw, I guess. We ought to get out of here. Just leave." Something brushed against her calf, light as a cat's questing paw. She jerked away from it with a little shriek. She looked down and cringed, one hand against her mouth. It was a balloon, as yellow as her blouse. Written on the side of it in electric blue were the words, "That's White Wabbit." As she watched it, it went bouncing lightly up the street, urged by the pleasant late spring breeze. 4. Richie Tozier makes tracks. "Well, there was the day Henry and his friends chased me, before the end of school, this was." Richie was walking along Outer Canal Street, past Basie Park. Now he stopped, hands stuffed in his pockets, looking toward the kissing bridge, but not really seeing it. "I got away from them in the toy department of Freese's." Since the mad conclusion of the reunion lunch, he had been walking aimlessly, trying to make his peace with the awful things which had been in the fortune cookies, or the things which had seemed to be in the cookies. He thought that most likely nothing at all had come out of them. It had been a group hallucination brought on by all the spooky shit they had been talking about. The best proof of the hypothesis was that Rose had seen nothing at all. Of course, Beverly's parents had never seen any of the blood that came out of the bathroom drain either, but this wasn't the same.
"No? Why not?"
"Because we're grown-ups now," he muttered, and discovered the thought had absolutely no power or logic at all. It might as well have been a nonsense line from a kid's skip rope chant. He started to walk again.
"I went up by City Center and sat down on a park bench for a while, and I thought I saw..."
He stopped again, frowning.
"Saw what?" "But that was just something I dreamed."
"Was it? Was it really?" He looked to the left and saw the big glass brick and steel building that had looked so modern in the late 50s and now looked rather antique and tacky.
"And here I am," he thought, "right back to fucking City Center. Scene of that other hallucination, or dream, or whatever it was."
The others saw him as the class clown, the crazy cut-up, and he had fallen neatly and easily into that role again.
"Ah, we all fell neatly and easily back into our old roles again, didn't you notice?"
But was there anything very unusual about that? He thought you would probably see much the same thing in any 10th or 20th high school reunion.
The class comedian who had discovered a vocation for the priesthood in college would, after two drinks, revert almost automatically to the wiseacre he had been. The great English brain who had wound up with a GM truck dealership would suddenly begin spouting off about John Irving or John Cheever. The guy who had played with the Moondogs on Saturday nights and who had gone on to become a mathematics professor at Cornell would suddenly find himself on stage with the band, a Fender guitar strapped over his shoulder, whopping out Gloria or Surfin' Bird with gleeful drunken ferocity. What was it Springsteen said? No retreat, baby, no surrender. But it was easier to believe in the oldies on the record player after a couple of drinks or some pretty good Panama Red. But, Richie believed, it was the reversion that was the hallucination, not the present life. Maybe the child was the father of the man, but fathers and sons often shared very different interests and only a passing resemblance.
But you say grown-ups, and now it sounds like nonsense. It sounds like so much bibble-babble. Why is that, Richie? Why? Because Derry is as weird as ever. Why don't we just leave it at that?
Because things weren't that simple, that was why. As a kid, he had been a goof-off, a sometimes vulgar, sometimes amusing comedian, because it was one way to get along without getting killed by the kids like Henry Bowers or going absolutely Looney Tunes with boredom and loneliness. He realized now that a lot of the problem had been his own mind, which was usually moving at a speed 10 or 20 times that of his classmates. They had thought him strange, weird, or even suicidal, depending on the escapade in question, but maybe it had been a simple case of mental overdrive. If anything about being in constant mental overdrive was simple. Anyway, it was the sort of thing you got under control after a while. You got it under control or you found outlets for it. Guys like Kinky Briefcase or Buford Kiss Drivel, for instance. Richie had discovered that in the months after he had wandered into the college radio station, pretty much on a whim, and had discovered everything he had ever wanted during his first week behind the microphone. He hadn't been very good at first. He had been too excited to be good. But he had understood his potential not to be just good at the job, but great at it. And just that knowledge had been enough to put him over the moon on a cloud of euphoria. At the same time, he had begun to understand the great principle that moved the universe, at least that part of the universe which had to do with careers and success. You found the crazy guy who was running around inside of you, fucking up your life. You chased him into a corner and grabbed him. But you didn't kill him, oh no. Killing was too good for the likes of that little bastard. You put a harness over his head and then started plowing. The crazy guy worked like a demon once you had him in the traces. And he supplied you with a few chucks from time to time. That was really all there was. And that was enough. He had been funny all right, a laugh a minute, but in the end he had outgrown the nightmares that were on the dark side of all those laughs. Or he thought he had. Until today, when the word grown-up suddenly stopped making sense to his own ears. And now here was something else to cope with, or at least think about. Here was the huge and totally idiotic statue of Paul Bunyan in front of City Center.
I must be the exception that proves the rule, Big Bill. Are you sure there was nothing, Richie? Nothing at all? Up by City Center. I thought I saw.
Sharp pain needled at his eyes for the second time that day, and he clutched at them, a startled moan coming out of him. Then it was gone again, as quickly as it had come. But he had also smelled something, hadn't he? Something that wasn't really there, but something that had been there? Something that made him think of...
I'm right here with you, Richie. Hold my hand. Can you catch hold?
Mike Hanlon. It was smoke that had made his eyes sting and water. 27 years ago, they had breathed that smoke. In the end, there had just been Mike and himself left, and they had seen... But it was gone. He took a step closer to the plastic Paul Bunyan statue, as amazed by its cheerful vulgarity now as he had been overwhelmed by its size as a child. The mythical Paul stood 20 feet high, and the base added another 6 feet. He stood smiling down at the car and pedestrian traffic on Outer Canal Street from the edge of the City Center lawn. City Center had been erected in the years 1954-55 for a minor league basketball team that had never materialized. The Derry City Council had voted money for the statue a year later in 1956. It had been hotly debated both in the council's public meetings and in the letters to the editor columns of the Derry News. Many thought it would be a perfectly lovely statue, certain to become a tourist attraction of note. There were others who found the idea of a plastic Paul Bunyan horrible, garish, and unbelievably gauche.
The art teacher at Derry High School, Richie remembered, had written a letter to the news saying that if such a monstrosity were actually to be erected in Derry, she would blow it up. Grinning, Richie wondered if that babe's contract had been renewed. The controversy, which Richie recognized now as an utterly typical big-town, small-city tempest in a teapot, had raged for 6 months, and of course it had been entirely meaningless. The statue had been purchased, and even if the city council had done something as aberrant, especially for New England, as deciding not to use an item for which money had been paid, where in God's name could it have been stored? Then the statue, not really sculpted at all, but simply cast in some Ohio plastics plant, had been set in place, still shrouded in a whack of canvas big enough to serve as a clipper ship sail. It had been unveiled on May 13, 1957, which was the Incorporated Township's 150th birthday. One faction gave voice to predictable moans of outrage, the other to equally predictable moans of rapture. When Paul was revealed that day, he was wearing his bib overalls and a red and white checked shirt. His beard was splendidly black, splendidly full, splendidly lumberjacky. A plastic axe, surely the Godzilla of all plastic axes, was slung over one shoulder, and he grinned unceasingly at the northern skies, which on the day of the unveiling had been as blue as the skin of Paul's reputed companion. Babe was not present at the unveiling, however. The cost estimate of adding a blue ox to the tableau had been prohibitive. The children who attended the ceremonies, there were hundreds of them, and 10-year-old Richie Tozier, in the company of his dad, had been among them, were totally and uncritically delighted by the plastic giant. Parents boosted toddlers up onto the square pedestal on which Paul stood, took photos, and then watched with mixed apprehension and amusement as the kids climbed and crawled, laughing, over Paul's huge black boots. Correction, huge black plastic boots. It had been March of the following year when Richie, exhausted and terrified, had finished up on one of the benches in front of the statue after eluding, by the barest of margins, Messrs. Bowers, Chris, and Huggins in a chase that had led from Derry Elementary School across most of the downtown area. He had finally ditched them in the toy department of Freese's department store. The Derry branch of Freese's was a poor thing compared with the grand downtown department store in Bangor, but Richie had been far past caring about such things. By then, it was a case of any port in a storm. Henry Bowers had been right behind him, and by then Richie had been flagging badly. He had dodged into the mouth of the department store's revolving door as a last resort. Henry, who apparently didn't understand the physics of such devices, had nearly lost the tips of his fingers trying to grab Richie as Richie trundled around and into the store. Pelting downstairs, shirt tail flying out behind him, he had heard the revolving door give off a series of reports almost as loud as TV gunfire, and understood that Larry Moe and Curly were still after him. He was laughing as he went down the stairs to the basement level, but that was only a nervous tick. He was as full of terror as a rabbit caught in a wire snare. They really meant to beat him up good this time. He had no idea that in another 10 weeks or so he would believe the three of them, Henry in particular, capable of anything short of murder. And he surely would have whitened with shock if he had known of the apocalyptic rock fight in July, when even that last qualification would disappear from his mind. And the whole thing had been so utterly, typically stupid. Richie and the other boys in his fifth grade class had been filing into the gym. A sixth grade class, Henry hulking among them like an ox among cows, had been coming out. Although he was still in the fifth grade, Henry went to gym with the older boys. The overhead pipes had been dripping again, and Mr. Fazio hadn't yet gotten around to putting up his caution wet floor sign on its little easel. Henry had slipped in a puddle and had landed on his keister. Before he could stop it, Richie's traitor mouth had bugled, "Way to go, Banana Heels!" There had been an explosion of laughter from both Henry's classmates and Richie's, but there had been no laughter on Henry's face as he picked himself up, only a dull flush the color of freshly fired brick. "Later for you, Four Eyes," he said, and walked on. The laughter died at once. The boys in the hall looked at Richie as one already dead. Henry did not pause to check reactions. He simply walked off, head down, elbows red from catching the fall, a large wet place on the seat of his pants. Looking at that wet spot, Richie felt his suicidally witty mouth drop open again, but this time he snapped it shut again, so fast he almost amputated the tip of his tongue with the falling gait of his teeth.
"Well, but he'll forget," he told himself uneasily as he changed up for gym. "Sure he will. Old Hank just hasn't got that many memory circuits working.
Every time he takes a shit, he probably has to look up the directions in the instruction booklet. Ha ha. Ha ha. You're dead, trash mouth, Vince Booger's Taliendo told him, pulling his jock up over a dork roughly the size and shape of an anemic peanut. He said it with a certain sad respect. Don't worry, though. I'll bring flowers. Cut off your ears and bring cauliflowers, Richie had come back smartly, and everyone laughed. Even old Booger's Taliendo laughed. Why not? They could all afford to laugh. What, me worry? They would all be home watching Jimmy Dodd and the Mouseketeers on the Mickey Mouse Club, or Frankie Lyman singing I'm Not a Juvenile Delinquent on American Bandstand, while Richie went shagging ass through ladies' lingerie and housewares on his way to the toy department, with sweat pouring down his back into the crack of his ass, and his terrified balls strung up so high they felt like they might be hung over his belly button. Sure, they could laugh. Hearty har har har. Henry hadn't forgotten. Richie had left by the door at the kindergarten end of the school building just in case, but Henry had stuck Belch Huggins there, also just in case. Hearty har har har. Richie saw Belch first, or there would have been no contest at all. Belch was looking out toward Dairy Park, holding an unlit cigarette in one hand and dreamily picking the seat of his chinos out of his ass with the other. Heart pounding hard, Richie had walked quietly across the playground and was most of the way down Charter Street before Belch turned his head and saw him. He yelled for Henry and Victor, and since then the chase had been on. When Richie reached the toy department, it had been utterly, horribly deserted.